This is Audible.
All But My Life by Goethe Weissmann Klein. Copyright 1957 by Goethe Weissmann Klein. This unabridged recording of the reading of All But My Life was published by arrangement with Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, Incorporated, and was produced in 1997 by Blackstone Audiobooks, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Grace Conlon. This book is 261 pages long. All But My Life by Goethe Weissmann Klein. The following material appears on the book's dust jacket. Soul Searching and Human, A Moving Personal Testament to Courage. Herbert Mietgang, The New York Times. A classic of Holocaust literature, Goethe Weissmann Klein's celebrated memoir tells the moving story of a young woman's three frightful years as a slave laborer of the Nazis and her miraculous liberation. All But My Life stands as the ultimate lesson in humanity, hope, and friendship. An unforgettable reading experience, All But My Life is one of the most beautifully written human documents I have ever read. In this respect, it is as sensitive and disturbing a story as is The Diary of Anne Frank, Library Journal. Goethe Weissmann Klein moves you, and not just because the story she can tell is so horrific. It is the passion with which she looked through the horror and found a heartfelt and basic goodness in humanity. All But My Life is filled with wonderful acts of decency and normalcy, even as she describes 3 years in labor camps and 3 months of a forced winter march from Poland to Czechoslovakia. Royal Ford, The Boston Globe. Goethe Weissmann Klein was born in Bielitz, Poland in 1924 and now lives in Arizona with her husband, Kurt Klein, who as a U.S. Army lieutenant liberated Goethe Weissmann on May 7, 1945. The author of 5 books, she has received many awards and honorary degrees and has lectured throughout the country for the past 45 years. One Survivor Remembers, a production of Home Box Office and the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, winner of an Emmy Award and the Academy Award for Documentary Short Subject, was based on All But My Life. Acknowledgements. I would like to share my joy and fulfillment on seeing my book go into print with the many friends who gave me encouragement. I should like to mention with special gratitude Mr. Sloan Wilson, who saw this book in its first draft, and whose enthusiasm gave me the courage to show it to the publisher. My warm thanks to Sarah Stone, who typed the manuscript tirelessly for a period of 3 years, and to Irene Goldberg, Rita Scharf, and Kate Sturman, who all helped with the typing. Dedication. I dedicate this book to the memory of my children's grandparents, Julius and Helene Weissmann Ludwig and Alice Klein, to the men of the 5th U.S. Infantry Division who fought for the ideals I believe in, and to my husband with all my love. G.W.K. Preface. As I finished the last chapter of my book, I feel at peace at last. I have discharged a burden and paid a debt to many nameless heroes resting in their unmarked graves. For I am haunted by the thought that I might be the only one left to tell their story. Happy in my new life, I have penned the last sentence of the past. I have written my story with tears and with love in the hope that my children, safely asleep in their cribs, should not awake from a nightmare and find it to be reality. Part 1, Chapter 1. There is a watch lying on the green carpet of the living room of my childhood. The hands seemed to stand motionless at 9:10, freezing time when it happened. There would be a past only, the future uncertain. Time had stopped for the present. Morning, 9:10. That is all I am able to grasp. The hands of the watch are cruel. Slowly they blur into its face. I lift my eyes to the window. Everything looks unfamiliar, as in a dream. Several motorcycles roar down the street. The cyclists wear green-gray uniforms, and I hear voices. First a few, and then many, shouting something that is impossible and unreal. Heil Hitler! Heil Hitler! And the watch says 9:10. I did not know then that an invisible curtain had parted and that I walked on an unseen stage to play a part in a tragedy that was to last 6 years. It was September 3rd, 1939, Sunday morning. We had spent a sleepless night in the damp, chilly basement of our house while the shells and bombs fell. At one point in the evening when Papa, Mama, my brother Arthur, then 19, were huddled in bewildered silence, my cat Schmutzi began to meow outside in the garden, and Arthur stepped outside to let her in. He had come back with a bullet hole in his trousers.
A bullet?
There is shooting from the roofs. The Germans are coming. Then, in the early gray of the morning, we heard the loud rumbling of enemy tanks. Our troops were retreating from the border to Krakow, where they would make their stand. Their faces were haggard, drawn, and unshaven, and in their eyes there was panic and defeat. They had seen the enemy, had tried and failed. It had all happened so fast. 2 days before, on Friday morning, the 1st of September, the drone of a great many German planes had brought most of the people of our little town into the streets. The radio was blasting the news that the Germans had crossed our frontier at Chechen, and that we were at war. Hastily, roadblocks had been erected. Hysteria swept over the people, and large numbers left town that day. I had never seen Bielitz, my hometown, frightened. It had always been so safe and secure. Nestled at the foot of the Beskid mountain range, the high peaks had seemed to shelter the gay, sparkling little town from intruders. Bielitz was charming, and not without reason was it called Little Vienna. Having been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire before 1919, it still retained the flavor of that era. Almost all of Bielitz's inhabitants were bilingual. Polish as well as German was spoken in the stores. In the center of the city, among carefully tended flower beds, stood its small but excellent theater, and next to it the Schloss, the castle of the Sukalskis, the nobility closely linked to the imperial Habsburgs. Nothing in my lifetime had ever disturbed the tranquility of Bielitz. Only now, when I saw people deserting it, did I realize how close, dangerously close, we were to the Czechoslovakian frontier. Only 20-odd miles separated us from Chechen. There had been talk of war for many weeks, of course, but since mid-August our family had been preoccupied with Papa's illness. Mama and I had been away in Krynica, a summer resort, from early June until the middle of August. Papa and Arthur had been unable to accompany us, and we returned when we received a telegram from Papa suggesting we come home because of the gravity of the international situation. It had been somewhat of a shock to see how ill Papa looked when he met us at the station. His right arm was bothering him, and Mama, alarmed, had called the doctor. The doctor diagnosed the illness as a mild heart attack, and Papa was put to bed immediately. The following day, two specialists were summoned to Papa's bedside. The same day, we received a cable from Mama's brother Leo, who was in Turkey. It read, "Poland's last hour has come. Dangerous for Jews to remain. Your visas waiting at Warsaw Embassy. Urge you to come immediately." Mama stuck the cable in her apron pocket, saying, "Papa is ill. That is our prime concern." Papa was to be spared excitement and worry at all costs, and visitors were cautioned not to mention the possibility of war to him. Mama little realized the fate we all might have been spared had she not concealed the truth from Papa. Yet on Friday morning, September 1, when German planes roared through the sky, Papa, who had been ill for 2 weeks, came face to face with reality. It was a tense day. I spent most of it in my parents' bedroom and instinctively stayed close to Papa. As that first day drew to a close, nobody touched supper. No one seemed to want to go to sleep. Mama sat in a chair near Papa's bed. Arthur and I watched from the window. Horses and wagons loaded with refugees continued to roll toward the east. Here and there a rocket, like blood spouting from the wounded earth, shot into the evening sky, bathing the valley in a grotesque red. I looked at my parents. Papa appeared strange, almost lifeless. The yellow flowers on Mama's black housecoat seemed to be burning. Outside, the mountain tops were ablaze for a moment, then they resounded with a thunderous blast that made the glass in the windows rattle like teeth in a skeleton's head. Everything was burning now. I looked at Mama again. Her soft, wavy, blue-black hair clung to her face. Her large, dark eyes seemed bottomless against her pale skin. Her mobile mouth was still and alien. The red glow was reflected in each of our faces. It made hers seem strange and unfamiliar. There was Mama burning with the strange fire of destruction, and in the street the horses and the wagons, the carts and bicycles, were rolling toward the unknown. There was a man carrying a goat on his back, apparently the only possession he had. On the corner, several mothers were clutching their infants to their breasts, and near them an old peasant woman crossed herself. It was as if the world had come to an end in that strange red light. Then, all of a sudden, Papa spoke to me. "Go, call the family and find out what they are doing." I went downstairs. I sat down next to the phone with a long list of numbers. I started at the top and worked to the bottom, but there were no answers. The telephones kept ringing and ringing. I pictured the homes that I knew so well, and with each ring a familiar object or piece of furniture seemed to tumble to the floor. I became panicky. It seemed as though we were alone in a world of the dead. I went back upstairs. My parents and Arthur apparently had been talking. They stopped abruptly. "Nobody answered, isn't that right?" Papa asked. I could not speak. I nodded. There was no longer any pretense. Papa motioned to me to sit down on his bed. He embraced me with his left arm. "Children," he said, "the time has come when I have to say what I hoped I would never have to say. I remember as if it were yesterday the cries of the wounded and the pale faces of the dead from that last war. I didn't think it possible that the world would come to this again. You believed I could always find a solution for everything. Yet I have failed you. I feel you children should go. Mama just told me that Mr. and Mrs. Eberson have asked to take you with them to look for refuge in the interior of Poland. I am sick when you most need my strength. I want you to go, children. I command you to go." His voice had assumed a tone of authority that I had never heard before. I saw Arthur look up startled at the mention of his girlfriend's parents. More than ever he looked like Mama, but somehow he reminded me of Papa as he stood there, tall, erect, and determined. Almost without hesitation he said, "No, we are going to stay together." My parents' eyes met. I had a feeling there was relief and pride in their faces. "I hoped you would say that," Papa said brokenly. "Not for my sake, but because I hate to cast out my children to complete uncertainty. I believe that God will keep us together and under the roof of our house." He dropped back, exhausted, on his pillows. The effort had been too much for him, and sudden stillness fell over the room. Strangely, all sound ceased outside as well, and we noted that the sky was no longer red. When I awoke the next morning, everything was as peaceful as ever. The sun shone so brightly in my room. The fall flowers in our garden were in full bloom. The trees were laden with fruit. In my room, everything was as it had always been, and what's more, even Papa was out of bed. His arm was in a sling, but he was up, and it seemed so wonderful I was sure the night before had all been a nightmare. No, not quite, because in my parents' faces I could read something that hadn't been there yesterday. When we met downstairs for breakfast, everybody seemed cheerful. Papa was joking. Mama joined in this seemingly carefree banter. The maid had left to be with her relatives. Papa jokingly asked me whether I wanted the job. Nobody mentioned the war. I walked to the radio and turned it on. There was a sharp click, but no sound. I tried the phone, the lights, but all electricity was off. In a way, that was good. There was no contact with the outside world. It was a wonderful, peaceful Saturday. But evening brought fury to the end of that last peaceful day. Sporadic shooting started from the rooftops, an attempt at delaying the enemy while our army retreated to Krakow. We looked for shelter in our cellar and sat there through the night. Toward morning, the shooting stopped altogether and the vehicles of the Polish army ceased to roll. We came up from the cellar for a cup of tea in the living room. As I sat down on the couch near the window, I could see the people outside in an obviously gay and festive mood, talking and laughing, carrying flowers, and everywhere the clicking of cameras. "Mama, look," Arthur said. "Do you suppose?" And he broke in the middle of the sentence, not daring to say what seemed impossible. "No," Mama answered, and then Arthur pulled his watch out of his pocket. The roar of a motorcycle broke the stillness of our home, and his watch fell to the floor. It was 9:10 a.m. I looked out again. A swastika was flying from the house across the street. My God, they seemed prepared. All but us, they knew. A big truck filled with German soldiers was parked across the street. Our neighbors were serving them wine and cakes and screaming as though drunk with joy, "Heil Hitler! Long live the Führer! We thank thee for our liberation!" I couldn't understand it. I didn't seem to be able to grasp the reality of what had happened. What are those people doing? The same people I had known all my life. They have betrayed us. The breakfast tea turned cold on the table. Papa and Mama looked down at the floor. Their faces were blank. Papa seemed so old, so gray. He had changed so much. I smelled something burning. A hot coal from the big green tile oven had fallen through the grill onto the carpet. I remembered a similar accident a year or two before, and Mama had been terribly upset. Afterward, she had turned the carpet so that the burn spot was under the couch. This time I wanted to shout a warning, but my throat froze when I saw my parents staring at that coal. They saw the carpet burn slowly, but they didn't seem to care. Finally, Papa got up and with his shoe carelessly shoved the coal back to the grill. Nobody spoke. I looked out the window and there was Trude, a girl I had known since childhood. She and her grandmother lived rent-free in a two-room apartment in our basement in return for laundry service. Now I saw her carrying flowers from our garden, white roses of which we had been so proud because they bloomed out of season. She handed them to a soldier, breaking her tongue with the unfamiliar German, "Heil Hitler!" The soldier reached for the flowers, but somebody offered him some schnapps. He took the glass instead. The flowers tumbled to the dusty road. The boots of the soldiers trampled on them. I started sobbing, crying, releasing all my emotions and anxieties in that outburst. Arthur jumped over to me, put his hand over my mouth. Are you crazy? Do you want to give us away? But I did not hear him. The tears felt so good. He finally slapped me. Think of Papa's life. If they hear you crying... I couldn't stop. He pulled me down from the couch, dragged me over the carpet and up the stairs with Mama holding my mouth. They put me to bed, where I cried into the pillow until, exhausted, I fell asleep. Early in the afternoon, the drunken, jubilant mob was still celebrating its liberation and hoarsely shouting, "Heil Hitler!" Papa and Mama smiled. Their smiles seemed more painful to me than my screams and tears, and I learned at that moment that I must not always cry when I wanted. I realized that we were outsiders, strangers in our own home, at the mercy of those who until then had been our friends. Although I was only 15, I had a strong feeling, more instinct than reason, that our lives were no longer our own, but lay in the hands of a deadly enemy. Mama tried to maintain the pattern of our life, even on that fateful Sunday. She prepared dinner and we sat down as usual, but no one could eat. And when the food was cleared away, we sat in silence. Arthur got out books about the war of 1914 and looked up data about its development, but Papa said, "This is a different war. This one cannot possibly last 4 years. 4 weeks, perhaps 4 months at most." Early in the evening, when the shouting of the drunken mob had died away, there was a knock at the door and a whispered, "Mrs. Weissman." It was our neighbor, Mrs. Bergman, the mother of my friend Eskia. She looked pale and shaken as she relayed the news that during the afternoon several Jews had been rounded up in the streets, locked in the temple, and the temple set on fire. "Men had better stay out of sight," she whispered. Papa and Arthur exchanged glances. Mama's eyes widened and she pressed her lips together. But Mrs. Bergman told us, too, that England and France had declared war on Germany that morning. She stayed only a few minutes. When she rose to leave, Mama saw her to the door and I followed them. Before they opened the door, Mrs. Bergman and Mama listened a while. Then finally Mrs. Bergman turned the knob and through a tiny opening glanced up and down the street before she slipped out. We sat a while longer in silence, none of us wanting to go to bed. That was the first evening in my life that I saw Mama without needlework in her hands. She just sat and stared into the fire. After a while she got up, outwardly calm and regal, and said, "Go to bed, children. We all will need rest and strength." Her words climaxed the first day under German rule. The next morning I was in the kitchen with Mama when Mrs. Rosch, one of our neighbors, came in with another woman and asked for our Polish flag.
"The flag?" Mama asked. "What for?"
"To make a German one, of course. It's really simple. You leave the red stripe as it is, cut a circle out of the white, and put a black swastika on it." Mama grew pale. At first she looked for our flag in places where she knew she wouldn't find it. Finally she brought it forth, knowing that she would have to sooner or later. Mrs. Rosch asked if Mama happened to have some black ribbon. She said she didn't. The other neighbor produced a piece. She told us it was good ribbon, that it would last for many years. Those two neighbors spent all morning sewing a Nazi flag to hang from our house. Why they did it, I'll never know. Perhaps they felt we would be inviting trouble not to display the flag. When the flag was finished, they asked, "Where's Arthur? He is big and strong. He could hang the flag." Mama sent me to call him. I found him in his room, lying in listless apathy. When I told him what was asked of him, he shouted, "Are you all out of your minds? Never, never, I won't do it. Tell them that I am gone. Tell them that I am dead. Tell them anything." And so Mrs. Rosch and the other woman struggled to fasten the flag through the little hole in the roof. I couldn't bring myself to look out of the window for days, but when I did,
There was the blood-red symbol of the tragedy that had engulfed us. Chapter 2. It took the Germans 18 days, 18 short days, to conquer Poland. No hope was left that our troops could send the enemy reeling back. Krakow fell, then Warsaw. Then the Germans still advanced without opposition. We waited now only for the liberation that would come from France or Russia, or, as a few optimists dared hope, from England or America. Many stories were circulated about the brutal methods which the Nazis employed in the East. Some Jews were coming back from areas overrun by the Germans. After what they had witnessed, they felt it was safer to return to their homes. Some came back to find their houses empty, most of their valuables gone, others to find their homes occupied by former maids, who graciously permitted the owners to spend a night or two in an attic or basement, perhaps let them take some of their clothes, and sped them on their way. Having been permitted to stay in the comfort of our own home, we did not have to worry, for the time being, at least, about shelter. Papa's next concern was his business. He was part owner of a factory that processed furs. Often he spoke of wanting to go to the factory to see what had happened to it, yet he knew, as we all did, that this would be too dangerous. We heard tales of people who went to their stores or factories only to find SS troops or the Gestapo there. They never returned. Bielitz was primarily a textile center with an international reputation for the fine fabrics it produced. The standard of living was higher than almost anywhere else in Poland because of the large number of skilled mill workers. There were warehouses all over town filled with fabrics. In the wake of the Wehrmacht, German officials appeared and requisitioned them all. We lived in the outskirts of Bielitz in a large, comfortable house that was over 100 years old. Although the upstairs had been remodeled when my grandparents were married, there were still uncovered beams in the kitchen ceiling, a wide hearth, cracked stone front steps, old-fashioned windows with latches, and, in place of central heating, large tile ovens in the rooms. I loved my home because it had so many mysterious nooks, a cold earthen floor in the cellar which I pretended was a dungeon, a rambling attic through which the wind howled, and best of all, a large garden and orchard. Part of it ran along the side of the house and joined a courtyard where there were several shacks in which we stored wood and kept chickens. Behind the house was the real garden running along a slope, for all of Bielitz was scattered over the foothills of the Beskid Mountains. Our garden had well over 100 fruit trees, some of them very old, countless berry bushes, and a garden house surrounded by lilacs. At the edge of the garden ran a tiny brook. This was the home I had known and loved all my life. It was not long after the whole population had been forced to register with the police that Jews received notices to turn in all gold, automobiles, bicycles, radios, even fountain pens. At first it did not seem to matter because we were still at home, but life soon became more and more difficult. One always had to keep vigil at the window, and when a car stopped in front of the house or the dreaded green uniform approached the front door, Papa and Arthur would hide in a closet. At first they refused to be intimidated. Papa protested over and over again, "I didn't do anything to anybody. I am not afraid." But Mama would just look at him, and that was enough. He would hide until we would sound the all clear. Many times we heard of instances when German soldiers came to a house for information, and if a man happened to open the door, took him along. Frequently, that was the last the family ever saw of him. We seldom sat down to a meal without interruptions of some kind. We became tense. We learned to distinguish the noise of the hateful boots at great distances. About the beginning of October, there was a timid knock at the door. It was not the ominous thump of the Gestapo, but a hesitant, tired signal. It is strange how many feelings a knock can express if you listen carefully. It was my father's sister Anna with her daughter Miriam, who was my age. Aunt Anna embraced my father and cried, my brother, how I thank God that he kept you for me. I am alone. Between sobs, she told us her tragic story. 2 days before the Germans entered Bielitz, she, her husband, and two children had boarded the train in an attempt to reach Warsaw. Day and night, the trains had been attacked. She told us how the engine had run out of water, and how the passengers had formed a human chain to pass along cups, bottles, and pails, filled with water for it, while the dead and dying lay all about them. There were nights when they had crouched beneath their seats, bombs and bullets flying over their heads. During one such attack, Aunt Anna had fainted, and her husband went to get some water to revive her. While he was gone, a bomb fell. When she regained consciousness, someone told Aunt Anna he had been torn to shreds. He never came back. Finally, the locomotive was hit and the train went no farther. Aunt Anna and her children got off and wandered on foot toward the east. It was a hot, oppressive night, she recalled. The moon was bright, and they saw what seemed like thousands upon thousands of shooting stars. They and others who were with them took it as a good omen and went on through a sandy little desert near Kielce. They moved steadily through the night toward a forest, counting on it to be their salvation after the heat. But there they met a closed line of German guns and troops. What they had mistaken for shooting stars had been German paratroopers. Now they had their first direct experience with the Nazi methods. First, the men were segregated from the women. Thus, just after having lost her husband, Aunt Anna saw her 19-year-old son taken away. The men were lined up, and every tenth one was shot. The rest were marched toward the forest. Aunt Anna ran toward the scene of the massacre to find her son. A few bursts from a machine gun quieted the moanings and cries of agony, and then the footsteps of the disappearing German column echoed away in the hot wind. Soon there was nothing left until the voice of 15-year-old Miriam beside her cried gently, "But, Mama, I want to live." On foot, by horse and buggy and by car, they came back to Bielitz. First Aunt Anna went to her home, but found a German family living there. She passed the houses of friends and relatives, but found them empty. She had hardly dared to hope that we would still be at home. Finding my father gave her new hope. They had no clothing except the garments they wore during their flight. They had no food, no money. Everything was lost. They stayed with us, of course. The next morning, another hesitant knock was heard at the door. It didn't seem possible when Aunt Anna saw her son on the threshold. She could hardly believe it was true. Such happiness is rarely experienced in the ordinary span of life. Yet it was David, haggard and hungry, but alive. He told us his part of the story. When he was taken into the woods, his group stumbled onto a small company of Polish soldiers who had been hiding. During the confusion and shooting, he had climbed a tree which still had a lot of leaves, and hid there until the Germans led their prisoners deeper into the woods. A short while later, uncounted shots took the lives of many. David waited in his secret roost until nightfall and then started his journey back, walking mainly by night, resting or sleeping in wooded areas or stables by day until he reached our home. Days passed like a dream, like an illness with no end in sight. We lived looking forward from one day to the next, glad when a night had passed and the Gestapo hadn't knocked at our door. A great change came over Arthur. He grew restless and tense. Books which normally occupied him day and night lay untouched. He would not leave his room. He didn't shave. He didn't dress. He hardly touched his food, and I doubt if he slept. One morning, when the war was almost 6 weeks old, Arthur announced at breakfast that he wanted to go to the center of town. We all knew that this was a dangerous venture. My parents realized that Arthur wanted to find out whether Gisa, his girlfriend, had come back from the interior of Poland, whither she and her parents had fled the day of the invasion. They raised no objection to his going, told him to use his own judgment. He shaved and left, saying only, "I am going now." Papa and Mama watched from behind the curtains as he went down the street. They trembled and caught each other's hands when they saw him pass a German soldier. They breathed easier when the soldier paid no attention to him. We waited anxiously, wondering how long it would take Arthur to come back, making allowance in case Gisa should have returned. I saw Papa swallow pills twice during that interminable wait. I watched Mama half-heartedly start several chores. We did not speak about Arthur or his mission, but were painfully aware that each minute might spell tragedy for him. Finally, after what seemed an eternity, we saw him coming slowly toward the house. He went up to his room without speaking. I went up to see him a few minutes later. Gisa's picture was on his night table. She was a lovely girl with big dark eyes and blonde hair. She smiled in that picture, but as I stood looking at it, her smile suddenly seemed sad. I had learned not to ask questions, so I stood quietly until Arthur spoke as if to himself. "The dog lies dead in front of her house."
"Rolf?" I asked.
He nodded. "I wonder," he said after a while, "whether he died from hunger or was killed, or whether he followed Gisa and her family and lost them along the way and came back to die." Chapter 3. In mid-October, a notice came in the mail ordering men from 16 to 50 to register. We were just sitting down to lunch when it came. Mama's eyes widened as she let her glance travel from Papa to Arthur. Her lips tightened as if suppressing a cry. Papa began to pull at his mustache with his healthy hand. Arthur and David looked at each other, then lowered their eyes and pretended to be preoccupied with their food. Aunt Anna was putting salad on Miriam's plate. Her hand quivered, the lettuce spilled, and I could think only one strange thought, that I had not realized how pleasant luncheon had been the day before. Finally, Arthur said quietly, "I have heard about it. I know what happens. Young men are taken deep into Poland to rebuild what was destroyed by the bombs." There was a quiver in his voice. Mama, Papa, and my Aunt Anna were pale as David added, "We will leave the day after tomorrow." So they had known, but had remained silent. I was surprised that Mama did not cry. She merely paced the floor, her lips pressed together. Papa's arm hung heavy in its sling. Aunt Anna said nothing. Later that afternoon, I went up to Arthur's room. He was looking through his books from time to time, glancing out into the garden where the first autumn wind was whining through the trees. Leaves were piling up on the grass. The day seemed exceedingly short. Neither of us talked much. Arthur tried several times to start a conversation, but when we tried to joke, our words seemed stilted, unreal. Finally, we fell silent. I didn't know my parents anymore. I didn't know my brother. I had never seen them silent. I would have preferred that everybody cried, that my parents cried, that the walls of the house cried, that it should rain and thunder. But this deadly silence was worst of all. The silence forced itself into my being, filled me with fright and wonder. When Arthur and David went to register the following morning, I accompanied them. Boys and men, many of whom we knew, stood in line, registered, got numbers. One of the boys, a classmate of Arthur's, told us that after registering, many boys from other towns were taken to camp and killed. "Nonsense," Arthur said to the boy. "What foolishness people try to invent." On the way home, we paused where the temple used to stand. It was a mass of charred wood and bricks and scattered glass. Only one pillar stood whole and proud, strong in the autumn wind. We crawled over the debris, not caring if anyone saw us or not. Arthur picked up a couple of pieces of glass and handed me one. He put a strong arm around me and said, "Look at that pillar. It is safe. We have to have faith. Never forget it, Gerda." I lost that little piece of glass somewhere in the woods of Czechoslovakia many years later, but I never forgot my brother's words. Aunt Anna, David, and Miriam had left earlier to spend the night with a family in the apartment house where they had lived before the war. The family had been fortunate enough to remain in the building and had spoken to the people who now occupied Aunt Anna's apartment, hoping that when they would see David leaving, they might give him some of his belongings to take along. Aunt Anna thought she might try this, but promised to be back in the morning. So we went home that sad day, October 18th, 1939. We went to Arthur's room. I sat down in a chair near the window and watched him. He sat at his desk, cleaning out drawer after drawer. Some papers he read and put back carefully. I was proud of my brother, although at times I resented girls who sought my friendship because they wanted to meet him. I often saw their envious glances when I was with him and was used to the question afterward, "Who was that dark, handsome boy with you?" I was always glad and proud to say, "My brother." For Arthur had something open and likable about him, and he had a frank, flashing smile that no one could resist. He made friends easily, old people and young alike. His wit and intelligence matched his appearance. Whatever he did extremely well. He had been cited for outstanding work in chemistry and was aiming for a doctor's degree in that subject. He wrote for a prominent publication, The Literary Guide. Just for the fun of it, he once started painting. One of his first pictures won a prize. I admired him. I often envied him. I remember him best sitting at his desk that last afternoon, looking through the mementos of his youth. Finally, Mama called us for dinner. It was as it had been all those years, those wonderful years of our childhood, when we played in our warm room, the autumn wind howling in the garden, the fire crackling in the dining room, all of us going there to share our delicious warm meal. But this was to be the last supper we would ever have together. Arthur carried the burden of conversation that night. Lingering over our tea, I could see my parents' desperate wish to prolong this evening as much as possible. Finally, Papa said, "You had better get to bed early tonight." That was the closest reference to the parting in the morning. I couldn't sleep that night. The wind was still whining in the branches of the trees. Somewhere in the distance, a dog barked pitifully. I tiptoed to Arthur's room. He was sound asleep. I remember sitting carefully at the foot of his bed, looking into the darkness, and there I fell asleep. The next thing I remember was Arthur's voice. "Please, Papa, let her sleep. She's still a child." I wasn't sleeping. I heard it all. I got up and ran down to the kitchen. It was still dark outside. Mama was busying herself with breakfast. She told me to put on my coat and gave me some money to try to get some rolls for Arthur. I was to find Zelowski. Zelowski had been our gardener and general handyman. Now he worked for a bakery and delivered rolls and bread in a huge basket. It was pitch black outside, and a fine cold rain was falling. There was a light in Arthur's window. He apparently hadn't finished his last-minute packing, and there was a light downstairs in the kitchen. The rest of the house was dark, and so were all the houses on the street except for a few lights in kitchen windows. Then I spotted Zelowski coming down the street. I ran to him. He was hard of hearing. I pulled a sleeve. "Zelowski," I said, "I want some rolls for Arthur. He's going away, you know."
"He's going away?" he asked, stupefied.
Zelowski had always adored Arthur. Whatever Arthur did was right in Zelowski's eyes. Whenever Arthur and his friends trampled on flowers and broke bushes while playing Indian, Zelowski always found a way to shift the blame from Arthur, even if it meant putting it on me.
He gave me some rolls, and I gave him the money. Too bad, he said. The boy was so bright. Shaking his old head, he started shuffling on his way.
What do you mean, he was? I shouted at him.
You won't see him again, he said. I started shaking his arm.
Zaloski, are you crazy? You're an old fool.
Some of the rolls spilled from his basket. He shook his head sadly.
I hate you, I screamed at him and kicked some of his rolls toward the gutter. Then I ran toward the house.
Papa, Mama, and Arthur were sitting at the table. I put the rolls in the bread basket. Mama poured Arthur's cocoa. I sat down at my place. I don't recall what they were talking about, but when Papa looked around, I felt that he was taking in the picture of all of us at the table. He wanted to say something, but his voice broke. With an abrupt movement, such as I had not seen since he had become ill, he got up and ran out. Mama indicated with her eyes that I should follow him, and she continued talking to Arthur, who appeared to ignore the incident. The scene in the hall upstairs was heartbreaking. Papa stood close to the door of Arthur's room, looking in where his clothing was carelessly thrown around. He leaned against the wall, his healthy arm held over his eyes. Thus bent, he hardly seemed the 6-foot man who had used to walk so erect. How gray his brown hair had turned. Then I saw big tears running down his cheeks. It was the first time in my life that I had seen my father cry. He was crying without a sound. Until then, my big, strong father had been the ultimate power, granting or denying everything in my life. Now he was as helpless as I. An overwhelming feeling of pity and pain swept over me. I embraced Papa. The touch of my arms made him shiver, and a suppressed and terrible sobbing cry rose from his throat, a cry which I will never forget, which had no resemblance to the human voice. It sounded rather like the cry of an animal when it has been stabbed and is dying. I was to hear that cry later many times when people were being killed.
Oh, Papa, Papa.
He motioned me away. I went back down to the kitchen. Mama was buttering a roll for Arthur, and they were talking. After a while, Papa came in, and Arthur looked at the clock. It was getting close to 6. Oh, my God, how fast the time had gone. There would be another 10 minutes before he would have to go. Then we would have to say goodbye. There was nothing now to prevent it from happening. The minutes stretched to eternity. I had a desire to get it over with as soon as possible. Finally, Arthur got up. He put on a short jacket over a navy blue sweater and lifted his knapsack, then set it down and walked over to Papa. He opened his mouth to say something, but then remained silent. Papa rose slowly. First, he raised his healthy arm, and then, with incredible effort, he moved his half-paralyzed right arm in a crude embrace. It was almost a miracle that he could bend that arm. We knew it caused him pain almost beyond endurance. He put his left hand on Arthur's black hair, then with a quick motion his right hand. It was for us children a familiar and comforting gesture. How pale his hands were now, but they did not tremble. Papa's glassy eyes looked up. Then he pulled Arthur toward him. His lips pressed Arthur's forehead. God be with you, my son. He took Arthur's shoulders and pushed him towards Mama's embrace. Her small, white, fine hands rested a moment on his head, but she was smiling. I never saw her look so strong. Arthur lifted both her hands to his lips and returned her smile with one of his gayest, saying, Maminka, which he used to call her when he was a very small boy. Mama said quietly, It is an easy goodbye, my child, because I know you will be back soon. Still smiling, she kissed his forehead. Then, with a quick, almost relieved gesture, Arthur turned to me, lifted me up, kissed me on both cheeks, and said gaily, It will be a pleasure not to have you always trotting behind me. That broke the tension.
I caught his arm and stood on tiptoe, trying to swallow my tears. He stooped down to me and whispered quickly, "Be strong, they will need you." Then he quickly ran down the steps to the sidewalk. We all followed. We wanted to go with him to the station, but he turned around. "Please," he said, "do me one favor. I don't want anyone to come." No, he didn't want us to see how he was going to be locked up in a cattle car under the whips of the Nazis. He started walking very fast down the street. It was just getting light. Then he slowed down. He stopped. I knew he wanted to turn around and to see the picture of his family in front of his house and wave a last goodbye, but he didn't. He hesitated a moment, but didn't turn around. Instead, he started to walk faster and faster toward the unknown. Chapter 4. Papa touched Mama's arm softly for a moment after Arthur was out of sight. I followed them back into the house. Nobody spoke. Papa and Mama found it difficult to be together that day. Papa withdrew to the Bible. Aunt Anna, when she returned, went into her room and closed the door. Mama put on a coat and shawl over her head and went out. I followed her to the cemetery a few minutes' walk from our house. It was on a hill, fenced in by a high brick wall. Some parts were very old, with tombstones dating back to 1700. Mama walked slowly along the gravel path, her steps quickening as we approached the section where our family was buried. Black marble tombstones with faded inscriptions rose from behind the shrubbery. I saw one fresh inscription gleaming in gold. "Julie Muckenbrunn." That was the grave of my mother's mother. She had died a year and a half before. I saw Mama put her head on the stone, as she must have put her head against her mother's breast many times as a child. Completely engrossed, she muttered, "My child, my child. Oh, mother," and started to cry bitterly. I could not catch all she said. It was a strange, quiet soliloquy, yet I felt that a voice was screaming within her, "Oh, God, bring him back to me." Then Mama stood upright and addressed the stone in a different manner. "You are lucky, mother. If only I could be certain that someday my children would be standing on my grave." When we reached home, I went straight to my room. There was no use to try to make conversation. Everyone had the desire to keep to himself. Idly, I started looking through a photograph album. I came across pictures that had been taken during the past summer. I lay down on my bed, looked up at the blue ceiling, and made a wonderful game of remembering the past, using these fragments to weave dreams for the future. No present existed. It was a wonderful escape. For instance, there was Krynica, where Mama and I had gone in the summer. It was an elegant summer resort, about 300 kilometers southeast of Bielitz. I recaptured the thrill, the excitement of the preparations, the dressmakers, the fittings, and finally the journey. I remembered it all so well. I had loved Krynica from the start. Our hotel faced the Carpathian Mountains on one side, beautifully landscaped gardens on the other. There was a wonderful swimming pool, tennis courts. If only Mama hadn't insisted on going to the promenade concert every afternoon, which meant being properly attired with hat and stockings. How I hated it. I remembered, too, the open-air concert we attended the day before we left. It was a lovely August afternoon, white benches, lovely flowers, happy people, deeply tanned men and women in colorful summer frocks. I was so proud of Mama. She looked beautiful in a navy and white print dress and wide-brimmed white hat. The orchestra played Viennese waltzes. She always smiled at those waltzes. They brought back her girlhood, for once at a ball in Vienna she was chosen waltz queen. Suddenly a slim young man ran up to the pavilion, pushed the startled conductor aside, and called out, "Are all you people crazy? Are you unaware of what's happening this very hour?" pointing toward the silent mountain peaks where Poland's frontier met German-occupied Czechoslovakia, he continued, "From up there, disaster is coming at any minute. There is going to be a war, and you are sitting here dressed up, listening to pretty music. Go home, take up arms, let us stand against the enemy." His white shirt was open at his neck, his sandy hair fell on his forehead, his hands were restless, his voice possessed a strange quality of power and conviction. Soon the police arrived and the young man was taken away. "A maniac," people muttered. "He will be locked up for disturbing the peace." But most everyone left the concert. Mama had thought that we should go back to Bielitz at once, but I urged her to stay on for another week as we had originally planned. Mama was still undecided when in the morning the telegram from Papa arrived saying that he wanted us to come home. We packed hastily and left on the next train. As we passed close to the Czech border, I wondered fleetingly if there would really be a war. The forests were green and looked so peaceful. The wheat stood ripe and rich in the fields, and peasant children waved to the swiftly moving train. But as we stopped at larger stations, the thought of war came back again. Baggage was piled high on platforms, crates, and trunks marked Warszawa, and large letters could be seen everywhere. In the early evening we arrived in Bielitz. Papa and Arthur met us at the station. At the sight of them my uneasiness vanished, although I noticed that Papa did not look well. He said his arm was bothering him. Mama was alarmed. "You look so pale, Julius," she said. "No," he answered. "It is you who are so tanned." The house was cool, and I experienced the wonderful feeling of being home again. Was it the day after our homecoming, or several days later, that Mama summoned the doctor for Papa, and that he was put to bed? But I did not want to think of Papa's illness now, or of the coming of the Germans, or of Arthur's going away. How much easier to think of all that had happened before the war, of my school, a private girls' high school run by Sisters of Notre Dame, where we were required to wear demure navy blue uniforms with light blue piping, brown rayon stockings, and simple shoes. Only during the summer vacation could we wear the clothes we wanted, yet the austere uniforms did not bother us in the least. They only made our summer clothes seem brighter, more desirable. These thoughts were a wonderful escape from the present. Comfortingly, the past was unwinding before me, my wonderful childhood safe and sheltered, too sheltered, perhaps, for what the years ahead were to bring, but full of lovely memories from which to draw strength. Days passed and stretched into a week without news from Arthur. Nobody had heard from any of the boys. Daily I went to the Kultusgemeinde, the Jewish community center, to find if word had been received from anybody. During the second week after Arthur's departure, when I had come home with yet another negative answer, Mama told me that Papa was resting and that Mr. Pipersburg was with him. That immediately put me into a better mood, for I adored Mr. Pipersburg. He was of medium height, had wavy gray hair, a small clipped mustache, friendly sparkling blue eyes, and an infectious smile. He was Papa's close friend and business associate. He was a widower with married children, so he now devoted himself to the factory. Charming and intelligent, he had traveled all over the world, knew many amusing stories, and always had one to suit any occasion. He spent much of his time in our house, and on holidays always brought us lovely gifts. Mama told me to go upstairs and announce that lunch was ready. Papa and Mr. Pipersburg were engaged in a serious talk when I entered, discussing the risks involved in going to the plant. It was too dangerous, they realized, and finally they decided that neither of them should attempt it for a while. The afternoon passed pleasantly. When Mr. Pipersburg got ready to leave, I decided that I would go with him part way to see Ilse, one of my friends. It was less dangerous for a girl of my age to venture into the streets than for a man. Ilse Kleinsoller was one of my best friends. Her father had gone with the same transport as Arthur, and she, her mother, and her 4-year-old sister Kitty had gone to live with her grandparents. Unfortunately,